Hello, and welcome to This Thing Called Life, a podcast dedicated to sharing stories about acts of giving, kindness, compassion, and humanity. Your host, Andy Johnson, will introduce you to powerful stories about organ, eye, and tissue donation from individuals, families, and healthcare teams whose experiences will inspire you and remind you that while life is hard, unpredictable, and imperfect, it's also beautiful. We are so happy you're here. Now, let's join the show.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to This Thing Called Life. I'm your host, Andy Johnson, and I am so excited to have you with us today. And I hope everyone is staying safe and healthy, and everyone has gotten off to a great start with the new year. So today's topic is one that is very important. And the woman who is my guest today is the subject matter expert about this particular topic. And really, this relates to often the things that many of us take for granted, the resources that we have available, or don't really appreciate what we have because it's just something that is in our life and we have access to it. So think a minute about the ability to just jump in your car and go to work, having the money to put gas in that car to get you to work, or being able to buy fresh produce and healthy foods. When we feel sick, we have the ability to go see a doctor and get medicine because we have insurance. But imagine this, having to choose between food or getting your prescription, a prescription that would save your life, or going to work sick because if you take off, you'll lose that job that's barely taking care of your family. Or think about being told that it's your own fault that you're in this predicament because you should have worked harder to get more in life. So with that, I want to introduce Renee Mahaffey Harris, who is president and CEO of the Center for Closing the Health Gap in Cincinnati. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you so much, Andy, for inviting me to be a part of this thing called life.
Thank you. I'm so happy that you're here because I think this is a really important topic that, quite honestly, there's been more attention put on it as of late as a result of the pandemic. But I just want to dive in and I'd love for you to just tell our listeners what the Center for Closing the Health Gap is. Let's start there.
So our mission is to lead the efforts to eliminate racial and ethnic health disparities in Greater Cincinnati through advocacy, education, and community outreach. How we do that is really through a process of engaging individuals with knowledge and engaging organizations that are serving the population of Black and Brown people in this region, so that we can develop interventions, create strategies that equip individuals with the knowledge to be a part of their own health solution. Mm-hmm. The more knowledge you have and the more understanding you have on the factors that contribute to your health, of which most people think that's all healthcare and all going to the doctor, but that only represents 20% of one's health. The other 80% are the things that we do every day,
right?
Our quality of life,
right?
From where we live to our economic capacity to our educational attainment to transportation to the actual physical environment of water and air quality, the socioeconomic factors that we hear about, and we hear about even more now in this country. COVID-19 really opened our eyes to this word, health disparities. Well, we've known it, and in 1985, Secretary Heckler, under the Reagan administration, did research, and that research was conclusive that race was a predictor of your health outcome. Mm-hmm. And in 2016, the federal government did a study to see where have we moved the needle, or have we, mm-hmm. in health disparities? And the alarming result was that we have not moved the needle in health disparities at all. Mm-hmm. There had been some narrowing, but no change. Mm-hmm. And then last year, COVID-19 hit.
Right.
And the conversation nationally was that there was a disproportionate impact of COVID-19 amongst Black and Brown people in this nation consistently. Mm-hmm. And I would love to say that those numbers changed, but they didn't.
Right.
And so the reasons for that, I know people were saying it's comorbidities, and But it ended up being more of the determinative factors. If you live in an environment where you don't have access to healthy food, obviously you're then not going to be able to have the, you know, maybe the ability to build a healthy immune system that can right. combat any disease. But we still don't know the answer to why the virus has had a disproportionate impact. However, we can go back in history and we look at the data. And so when you look at greater unemployment rates, the fact that Black and brown people are essential workers delivering either, you know, housekeeping or those essential jobs, they must be present. And so, you know, I know recently, you know, even what we saw last Wednesday, my daughter asked me, she said, wow, you know, there's all this focus on, you know, getting the elected officials out and their staff. But what about the folks that are going to have to come in and clean up that space?
That's right.
Who is protecting them? That's and so right. that's, you know, I have to believe that's a reason that we are seeing a disproportionate impact mm-hmm. because those aren't conversations we talk about.
Right.
And not to say that income is the predictor of the impact of COVID-19. It isn't. Right. But that disproportionate impact to Black and brown people of all ages and all walks of life.
Right.
is real data. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as Dr. Fauci said early on in March, he said, you know, I think a reporter asked him, why do you think COVID-19 is having a disproportionate impact on Black and brown people? And he said, well, how much time do you have?
Right. Remember that.
And I mean, that was, you know, having him say that. And even though I stated already that the conversation and the data supporting why health disparities emerged as a national crisis by the World Health Organization and by this country, but really not a lot of attention and conversation on. But COVID-19 brought it forth loud and clear.
It really did. And it was almost this, I saw it as this conversion. It was a conversion of COVID-19, the pandemic, and then also the racial unrest that occurred. And I felt like the kind of merging of those two, happening around the same time really forced a conversation that this country has needed to have for a very long time in talking about systematic racism and health disparities among people of color. How do you see that correlation?
Well, what happened, I think, last year was a trifecta. Mm. So it was not only COVID-19, but it was COVID-19. It was the economic impact of COVID-19 on Black and brown communities.
Yes.
And then racism and the understanding of systematic and structural racism being the undergirding and root causes of the disparities that we see. And so, you know, as a result, you saw over 148 cities and municipalities declare racism a public health crisis.
Yes. Including Hamilton County.
Including Hamilton County and the city of Cincinnati.
Yes. And you were key in making that happen.
So yes, I was involved both in the county and the city and the statewide effort to declare racism a public health crisis, which is simply a declaration. The real meat that I hope to see move forward is how we're going to look at the data sets that help us understand how policies and practices perpetuate systemic and structural racism in all aspects of the delivery of care, delivery of services. I'm not really talking about healthcare, but I'm talking, I'm just trying to think of something simple, like even looking at, you know, looking at MSD, let's pick that. So let's look at the neighborhoods in which there are greater, you know, incidents of sewer related issues. Mm-hmm. And so this is not just here, but across the country. And so, and the highways are really a great way to really help you understand it. So I'll use Cincinnati as an example, but across the country, this is a norm. Mm-hmm. So over the decades, as our highway systems built, 9 times out of 10, those systems went through Black or brown or marginalized communities.
Right.
Where people were uprooted from their homes. If they owned a home, they lost their home by eminent domain. I can speak to my own parents whose parents had a home in Evanston. Mm-hmm. They moved there, bought a house finally. They had been trying to buy a house and they were able to buy a house and it was probably a year, but within 2 years, they started hearing rumors around the community that the highway was going through. So clearly, we know that planning and how that planning occurs, they knew before,
right?
Those individual,
right.
You know, families moved into that neighborhood, that a highway was originally eventually going to go through that neighborhood.
Yeah. The transportation planning takes years and years and years. So you're absolutely right.
So that's just one example of you know, a factor that you don't necessarily think about when you think of systemic racism. When you look at the percent of Black men who are incarcerated in this country, in many cases on charges that have to do with marijuana possession, but they receive the maximum, you know, when you look at the rates of police stops. And so the data starts telling us not only, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement as a result of many deaths at the hands of a police officer. But when you see George Floyd and when that video went live and people could really begin to see the humanity, it sparked a movement in this country and an understanding of the systemic and structural factors that contribute.
I don't know. Again, I think it was the trifecta that you're speaking to, because the reality is, those videos, we've seen the George Floyds and others. I mean, because that's the power of the cell phone now, right? I mean, right. That was nothing new, but for whatever reason, it just that grabbed people's attention, everyone, and that sparked, you know, this movement, which I just thought was interesting. And again, I took it back to, you know, people have more time on their hands. They're watching TV more. Like you can't escape what's happening in our country. You talked about last Wednesday. What I found so interesting was this visual of how the Capitol looked when the Black Lives Matter protests were going on, the police presence compared to what we saw last Wednesday. And I thought, if this does not explain to people what white privilege is, I don't know how else, you know, you can help people to understand that this is real, you know?
Yeah, I think it was like further unveiling, but of that truth that there are differences between being Black and white in America.
Yes.
Period. Yep. And not debatable anymore. Here, the evidence is overwhelming and has been overwhelming. But again, Wednesday just further exacerbated the truth.
Yes, absolutely. So do you find the inequality in healthcare? Do you think it's based, is it a combination of being based on both race and socioeconomic?
No.
Okay.
So health disparities, and I think there's a perception that health disparities, which I learned even with the health gap, that people who even worked with us felt that health disparities had to do with your income. I'm like, oh, no. All right. The data from Secretary Heckler showed the difference between a Black man and a white man, same income. So, you know, kind of say corporate level salary. Mm-hmm. Their outcomes in health and going into the healthcare system were divergently different. And so the data shows that in spite of your economic circumstance,
really?
Health disparities persist. And so the maternal health the maternal health issue helped people see that more clearly. That's always been the case. Uh-huh. It has always been the case. There's an assumption that because a person maybe has less means, then that's why. Mm. But it's regardless of socioeconomic status that health disparities persist.
Really?
So I'll use maternal health outcomes as an example. And so, you know, I think when you saw stars like Serena Williams experience health inequality in her experience in the healthcare system, mm-hmm. where she knew her disease, she knew what she needed done, and that there were medical providers that said, "Oh no, there are data and research on residents who prescribe less medicine to Black children and Black adults because they have a perception that Black people maintain a higher degree of pain. Doesn't matter the age."
Where does that come from? Where
so
does
I think
that
gets back
from?
To systematic and structural racism. It gets back to this perception of And it probably goes back in history. So when you think about slavery and you think about the Jim Crow era, and then you think about civil rights. And so when you look at all of those historic settings and see that race was the commonality, right?
Right.
And that the inequity that persisted in the beginning, to think that that inequity would go away just because there was prosperity, and it didn't change. Yeah. And so there's a perception, like even when President Obama was elected, it was a perception that, wow, we don't have racial issues in our country anymore. It's like, oh, that's really fascinating, because one has nothing to do with the other.
Right.
You know, I would love to be able to explain why a trained medical provider would have a, but I think that goes back to the bias of how you were raised and your culturation from childhood. Mm-hmm. If all you see is someone that looks like you, and it appears that what you have comes easier, maybe that's not true. I'm sure that's not true. And that because we grew up, and frankly, segregation is one of the biggest determinants of inequities being more impacted in a community. And so, you know, for instance, this region in Cincinnati is still the fifth most segregated city in America. And so, so when you think about segregation, right, that means it might be separate and assume it's equal, but it's not.
Right.
And so, you know, those are, I think, those are some of those systematic structural factors that we're talking about. Do those change overnight? No. How do they change? Policies and practices must change them. And that means the accountability to hold people accountable to those policies is one of the factors that contribute to the continued systemic structural racism that we see today. Mm. I don't think anybody wakes up in the morning and says, well, I think I'm going to be racist, or I think I'm going to treat this person differently.
It's unconscious bias.
It's unconscious bias. And so, you know, we've had this movement of, oh, we're going to, you know, take tests to understand your bias or your, I forget the word right now, but the test that we take to determine what our bias is, right?
Oh, okay.
I don't know why.
I know what you're
I can't think of the word of the name of the test, but I don't know why I can't think of it, but you know, there are things that, like growing up, if you're in a school and everyone looks like you, or if you're in a school and say you're the one person that doesn't look like everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I can say that from my own experience. I went to an elementary school and it was just myself and my sister. I happened to been raised in a household where I was told that, you know, encouraged that I could do anything I wanted. And so I never realized that my raising my hand and not being called upon or being able to run for my class president in sixth grade was because of the color of my skin, even though I was told that I couldn't run for sixth grade president because I was Black. And I came home and told my parents that. And, you know, my dad, I actually did not really know that until recently. And he said, yeah, I remember when you came home and told me that. And what's interesting is I think, like, you know, he didn't feel that he had the power to go and say something about that. Right.
Right.
But it went by. And frankly,
again, that goes back to that whole idea of systematic racism, really not feeling like, because if that situation were reversed and your father were Caucasian, that he wouldn't feel less than, you know what I'm saying?
Like you couldn't come and say something
about
it. Yeah. Cause I think when you look at, you know, I look at my parents' era of, you know, you don't rock the boat. You don't, you know, you don't want to end up losing your, you know, those fears.
Right.
And then the more education as we became more educated.
Stressor.
Right. So, and stress is one of the factors that is the constant contribution to the disparity. And so, you know, there's a Harvard professor by the name of David Williams. He's a sociologist and he's done extensive study of the impact on stress to Black people and why that's the bigger correlation. So when you asked the question about socioeconomic status, that's why, right?
Got it.
Because if you wake up and you go in a store, doesn't matter what your income is. Mm-hmm. Someone follows you in a store, doesn't matter what your income is. Or you go into a sporting event and you're, you know, it doesn't matter your income. What is seen as your race, and what immediately is responded to is either fear or something else. And so I think what we have experienced with COVID-19 that gives me hope is that, yes, it shows this disproportionate impact, which just keeps reinforcing what we keep saying. And it's going to take more than a declaration of racism as a public health crisis. It's going to take more than one person. Yeah. It's going to take whole systems recognizing that the system is built on some inequities based on bias that we don't really even realize we have.
Right.
So I think it's going to take time. I don't know that I believe it's going to happen in my generation.
Yeah.
I hope that it happens in the next generation. But when a system in this country has been built with bias of privilege, as Frederick Douglass said, no one concedes power, never have, never will. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that it's just going to take time. I know it's conversations, but I think it's beyond conversation now. It's actually, let's look at policies and practices. Let's overlay that with where people live. Mm-hmm. And let's look at the percentage mm-hmm. of people that are stopped by the police in this neighborhood versus another. Let's look at the rates of incarceration for the same mm-hmm. types of crime committed. So I'm using, you know, the criminal justice system as one example, but you could do the same with the percent of people with transportation, mm-hmm. look at the, you know, percent of people that rely on public transportation and whether or not the economics enable them to be able to get to where jobs are.
Access to healthy foods. I know that
access to healthy foods is one of the easiest ones to see,
right?
Because if you don't have transportation mm-hmm. and you're relying on public transportation to go to a grocery store, we all know how much we can fit in our car. How much could you fit if you had a shopping cart?
Right.
And your mother with children or a senior, there's only so much that you can carry.
Right.
And so the places that are more accessible are convenience stores that have high concentrations of sodium, canned goods with sodium. Granted, we did some efforts to try to help educate those convenience store owners so that they would mm-hmm. make their shelf makeup increase the water, the amount of water versus soft drinks, the amount of low sodium canned goods, mm-hmm. Wheat-based pastas, 1% milk, 2% milk. And we ran into this kind of wall was that you really needed a wholesale mechanism to be able to have those convenience stores be able to buy it at a price point that they would then not pass along those increased price points to the consumer.
Right.
And so, you know, I think there's still work to be done. We still have 10 fewer stores in this community than the national average, although in Avondale, they've taken a step in getting a produce market, but it's still not a full service grocery store.
Right.
And so I think, you know, I think that issue is going to take continued advocacy, but at the end of the day, grocery stores only have a very small margin of profit. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to locate where they're going to have greater accessibility to people driving in to them. Right. And so we're going to have to continue to work on those barriers across the board. But I do think that the conversation and continued conversation on systemic structural racism and saying it and understanding what it is will enable us to get a little further than we have to date. Mm-hmm.
This is such great information. Like, I could talk to you for hours about this topic. And we have talked a lot about this topic.
We have. And I mean, thinking about Life Center and thinking about the number of Black people who are on waiting lists for kidney transplant or liver transplant, and some of the mistrust in the systems of care that cause, I guess I can say this now that I'm on this podcast, but I remember early on that I did not have donation on my driver's license mm-hmm. Because of the perceptions of my community, the perceptions that had been told. I just remember this message, like, well, you know, if we're in the hospital and you're like near death, then they're not going to save you because you're Black. And the fact that perpetuated in the Black community and that I was functioning from that information until I learned something different from you.
Glad I had that.
But, you know, here I'm somebody that works in this space. And so I was like, ooh, wow. Like I let a myth stop me from saving a life. And so, and also I had a cousin who died of leukemia and she needed a bone marrow transplant and there was a small registry. And so that also, you know, that issue as well. And you don't know until it's crisis, and we can't necessarily begin to be preventative if we don't start doing more things up front.
So how do we move, because you bring up a great point in talking about these myths and misconceptions that I think that they linger in families for generations, and then to a lot of people, they're just true, and there's no way of getting around that. And we know that that comes from this mistrust. And we know it comes from, you know, the experiments and things that were wrongly done to Black people in this country. How do we begin to move away from that? I know, you know, I've been in this role a while, and I feel like education is key, and we just have to keep doing the education. We have to keep sharing the stories. We have to, you know, give people the facts so that they can make an informed decision. But how do we get past this lack of trust? Because it's not just with organ donation. We've seen it in hospice.
It's across the board in every area. It's in every area. And so, just as the conversation on the vaccine and the immediate response and the early survey said that, you know, it doesn't matter what your income was. It didn't matter what your profession was. I don't know. I think I'm going to wait a year. The response was, well, the first people who have trust are Black physicians and Black healthcare providers. Yeah. And so that was kind of where we leaned into first, in having Black physicians who were part of the trials. Mm-hmm. We, you know, through the COVID-19 communityresources.com site that we launched at the early set of the pandemic, because we knew that there needed to be a place where there was trusted information. So joined forces with the African American Chamber, the Urban League, the NAACP, the Cincinnati Medical Association, and one of our new, she wasn't a council member at the onset of our work, but became one, yeah. J. Michelle Kearney. And providing a place where people could go and not just find out about COVID-19, but how to apply for unemployment, mm-hmm. how to apply for PPP, where you can find food banks and or places that are delivering free meals, mm-hmm. understanding what you could do about your own health, and just some of the mental health services that are available and making it easier to find that information. That was an important site to launch so that there was a trusted place. And it has grown since then, since March 23rd when we launched it. Mm-hmm. And the vaccine conversations we've had in our town hall. So we've had close to 30 town halls.
Right.
The most recent 4 town halls have all been about the vaccine.
Okay.
And so we've had physicians on, public health leaders such as okay. Commissioner Moore and Dr. Odell Owens and others mm-hmm. to talk about the information from the factual basis, mm-hmm. because there's lots of myths out there and lots of conspiracy theories. And all we can do is provide information, but that information first has to come from people that look like the people who are questioning the information. So we have to inform each other first and then expand that to other leaders who are trusted delivering those messages. The more people that are receiving the vaccine, standing up and putting something on social media, hey, I got the vaccine. The vaccine is the only way out of COVID-19. So that's the reality. Yeah. And before we even got to the vaccine conversation, we provided education on how clinical trials happen. Mm-hmm. The fact that we're this very small percentage of most clinical trials. However, like in the case of diabetes, we may be the largest consumer or recipient of the medications. But mm-hmm. if we're not participating in the trials, research is now showing that some of the factors contributing to loss of life have more to do with the fact that we weren't in the trial. Mm. And so that's why I remember with the vaccine, you saw we are going to ensure and do our best to make sure 30% of the vaccine participants are Black or Brown.
Right.
And that was important because if that disproportionate is to us and we are not representative from a statistically significant representation, then that question would linger. And so that's not just in the trial participation, but it's also in the trial in creation of and identifying a vaccine, and then also even understanding, because, you know, like all the myths, you know, it's like, well, why couldn't we have a vaccine or a solution to HIV AIDS? And understanding that this conversation about SARS vaccine has been
right.
So it's that they were able to take COVID and right. find a way to respond to it. And so, but once you understand that,
right.
then you're able to have more information.
Cause the piece about, you know, this being worked on for so long as because of SARS, I didn't realize that until I happened to be watching 60 Minutes one night. And that's when that came out. And I was like, that is so interesting. It's just, I'm so glad that your organization has these resources and that it's helping to develop trust around, you know, this, the whole idea of the vaccine. We need more of that, quite frankly. But I think as you're talking about that foundation and kind of as we're addressing systematic racism and that sort of thing, like it's taking that step to build that foundation. And we need to see more of that in all areas in our society, quite frankly, if we're going to move forward. So what would you say to the person, and I know people who they don't believe that this whole idea of health disparities or systematic racism exists in our country?
What would I say?
Yeah.
I probably would start off with giving them some data that shows here's what the data looks like. Here's what the data has looked like for decades.
And you can't deny data.
So you can't deny data. There's data across the board. There's data related to disease impacts mm-hmm. or disease outcomes, mm-hmm. regardless of race, regardless of economic, socioeconomic standing or whatever, your socioeconomic status. There's data that shows actual data from wherever systems report data showing the persistent gaps in care. Again, that comes from the bias, which stems from the training, either in medical school, nursing school. And so that all of those mechanisms haven't kind of taken out
right.
those biases. And I don't think that anyone wrote them with a bias intent, but whoever wrote the books, right, from their perspective. And, you know, when I read statistics, and recently I've presented on health disparities, and yes. and I've shown some disparities around research studies that have been published about residents and medical professionals' mm-hmm. perceptions. One which shocked me was a perception that doctors and residents had relative to Black people's blood coagulating differently. I mean, so it wasn't just about the pain. There were right. some deeper like pieces of like care, like how you receive care that wow. there were perceptions around. And until we hear those mm-hmm. research studies that show that disparity, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we have to hear those harsh realities mm-hmm. and then start thinking about where does that begin? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it begins in the training, which means that you have to then look at, you know, the training that people then take boards for that then permit them to deliver care.
Right.
And see like how you take the bias out of that.
Right.
And I think that's going to take a lot of time.
Yeah.
It's going to take a lot of time. But in the meantime, you know, I know that the whole notion of cultural competency has been around for some time, but it seemed to be turned into more of a class, check the box, you took the cultural competency class. How do we, and so one of the easy ways is to increase the percentage of Black physicians,
yes.
Both female and male, because there's a larger percentage of female physicians. Mm-hmm. Black men's outcomes to COVID-19 have been disproportionately worse than women. Mm-hmm. And so that means Black men are more likely to listen to another Black male physician. Mm-hmm. So obviously if the percent of physicians is, you know, less than 5%, and in Cincinnati, it's less than, for all doctors that are Black, it's 2.6%. So I'll assume of that number, it's a smaller percentage of Black men. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of work to do, to look at our high school and elementary school STEM programs and educational pathways yes. that lead to being able to have the grades and capacity to yes. be admitted to medical school.
Yes. So we're going to wrap up here, but I wanted you to talk a little bit about the the new campaign that the Health Gap recently launched. And I think you guys have done, your organization has done just so many phenomenal outreach initiatives and education initiatives over the years. And how long has the Health Gap been in existence?
16 years.
Wow. Wow. And are there any other organizations in the country that are like the Health Gap? In
so not specifically. There are other organizations that are focused on health equity and health disparities. What makes the Health Gap unique is that we are a health disparity organization that conducts its own data and research and house and maintain our own data sets.
Wow.
Oftentimes across the country, you'll see collaborations between academic institutions and community-based organizations. Right. We did find probably about 10 years ago or a little more, we found an organization in Harlem that had a similar mission, mm-hmm. but all of their work was only focused on the data. Mm-hmm. Whereas we have focused on the data, and I will say that nothing we have done has been able to be done alone. Right. So we've had some really great collaborations. We are not a big organization, so it's through those collaborations right. that we have been able to inform some other primary partners and or institutions that could then look at a different way to be able to approach health disparities. Mm-hmm. And so, so I can't say we've done it alone.
Yeah.
It's partnerships. I think COVID-19 and the work we've done relative to COVID-19 would not have happened without partnerships. The
right.
campaign you referenced, We Must Save Us, involves 60 organizations helping recruit from Black communities as well as Hispanic communities.
Okay.
We designed the commercial both for Black audience, but also for the Hispanic audience. So the commercial was done in right. Spanish as well. All of the collateral materials are in both languages. And so that is the result of working with other organizations that's their daily work, right?
Right.
And so, you know, our mission says to lead the efforts. That doesn't mean that we're doing all the work.
Right.
But if we can at least use the role that we have as a leader in addressing health disparities to collaborate with organizations who are serving other specific needs from an economic need to just a whole host of areas of quality of life factors that many organizations are addressing. As we partner, then we're able to give greater exposure, greater knowledge, and training more people. I really believe that I think our perspective on how we do that may be different than other organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And so oftentimes we kind of get stuck on who's the expert.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we need expertise to drive the education, but that education needs to be whittled down to something that everyday people can understand and convey
right.
to each other.
Right.
And so our work is co-created with mm-hmm. people in the community, and that's what makes it trusted. And then that also helps be the bridge to other areas of not so trusted avenues.
Right.
And that's how you break down those walls.
Yes. Yes. So We Must Save Us. The campaign is addressing what?
So right now it is addressing COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
So if the commercials addressed what we still need to do to mm-hmm. mask up and mm-hmm. watch our distance and wear and wash our hands.
Yes.
But it also addressed the fact that if we don't do that, we will continue losing lives. We also address taking the vaccine when it's here and available to you. And then we also did some broader research with focus groups. We also did support groups with mental health professionals, really so that we could understand the impact to people's mental stability and anxiety yeah. levels related to COVID-19 for both Black and Brown people. We also did focus groups that were specific to men so and women and all ages so that we could understand how people's lives are being impacted, what kind of information they need and mm-hmm. want, how they want to receive that information.
Okay.
Because that's half the battle. Sometimes
right.
marketing approaches are built for one audience, and really to have the effectiveness, it needs to be drilled down into the kind of subsets of mm-hmm. of populations of different people and how they receive information. And
mm-hmm.
so this campaign starts with the vaccine and COVID-19. I think it will grow into How We Must Save Us relative to having disproportionate outcomes in most disease outcomes.
Right.
While we may not be the majority of the population or the majority, I'll use breast cancer as an example. We are not the majority of the population that have breast cancer. However, the mortality rate for Black people is greater. Mm. And so it's all of those spaces of disease where we have the highest mortality rate that we must continue to work to save us.
Right.
And that means an understanding that you need to be an organ donor and why you need to be an organ donor and why you may have a family member, or probably every person can name a family member with diabetes, sometimes controlled and sometimes not controlled, and what that then results in.
Right.
And so the more educated we are and the more that we understand those correlations, then the more we can do, because health is really a marriage of healthcare, who are designed to take care of us when we are sick.
Yes.
And doctors are designed to help us be preventative, but also take care of us when we're sick.
Right.
So they need us to be in partnership with them.
Right.
And that means we need to understand what we can do for ourselves.
Wow. That's all I can say is wow. I mean, the Center for Closing the Health Gap, your organization is truly doing groundbreaking work. And I think you should be very proud to be leading this organization. And I do think that as you were talking about the change that needs to occur in order to start to address these issues of health disparities and systematic racism, I think it's organizations like the Health Gap that will help drive that change. And so I appreciate everything that you are doing for the city of Cincinnati and beyond, because I know that you do quite a bit of research and data, and I think it's going to have it's going to impact communities all over our country. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And I'm really grateful to be at this place in my life where I can take all that I've learned over the decades and be able to serve and be a part of, I think, be a part of the solution. At least that's what I'm hoping I'm doing.
Yes, you definitely are. And we appreciate you, and as a member of this healthcare community, we're lucky to have you
at
the table leading these discussions so that we can enact change and empower our community. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you. So as I have a couple more questions for you, so just hold tight. But at this point in the show, we have what we call an honor moment where we acknowledge or celebrate or honor someone. And I'd like to dedicate the show's honor moment to Capitol Hill Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who died on January 7th as a result of injuries that he sustained when the Capitol building was under siege. So we just want to honor him. And we also want to honor Officer Howard Liebengood, who also died and was a Capitol Hill police officer. So as we wrap up, I also want to do just a couple questions so people can know who Renee is. That's what I like to do with my guests. So what's your favorite restaurant? I already know this.
I'm Cooper's Hawk. I think it's one of my favorites.
Yes.
It's one of my favorites.
It's either Cooper's Hawk or E&O.
Yes.
And what do you do when you're feeling overwhelmed?
I stop and pray.
Stop and pray. Very good. Well, Renee, I really, really appreciate you having you taking the time to be on the show with us today. This was a lot of great information. So I want to leave our listeners with a couple of resources, websites. For more information about health disparities and the different work that the Health Gap is doing, please visit their website at closingthehealthgap.org. You can also get information regarding resources around COVID-19 if you go to COVID-19communityresources.com. And as we close the show today, there are 108,108 men, women, and children in need of life-saving organ transplants in our country. And today, 20 people have died because they didn't receive a transplant in time. What can you do to help? You can register to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor, or consider being a living donor, because the vast majority, 91,457 of those men, women, and children need a life-saving kidney transplant. Thank you all for listening. Please be kind to yourself and to others. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Life Center. You have the potential to help save and enhance the lives of others. Those who suffer from chronic illness or the effects of traumatic events. Statistics have shown that a new name is added to the national waiting list every 10 minutes. You have the opportunity to help others and save lives. You have the power to donate life. By designating your decision to become a donor, you have the opportunity to change the lives of many and save up to 8 lives. Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana say yes to donation by registering to become an organ, eye, or tissue donor today. Go to lifepassiton.org for more information. Thanks to LifeCenter for their continued support. Thank you for listening to This Thing Called Life. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your favorite podcast to make sure you get updates on all new episodes. And we would truly appreciate it if you would share, like, or give us a review to help us grow.